This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Winning: The Unforgiving Race to Greatness by Tim S. Grover with Sherry Lesser-Wenk. Read by Pete Simonelli. Featuring dialogue with the authors.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Grover, and I'm here with my co-author, Sherry Wenk.
Hi, everyone.
We want to welcome everyone to Winning, the Unforgiving Race to Greatness. We all have the ability to win. We've won numerous times, but the desire to constantly win, to have more, to taste winning, to feel winning, you have to understand winning. That's the road we're going to take you on. So don't buckle up, because that seatbelt is not going to save you on this ride. Be ready for an experience that very few want to talk about, very few understand, very few will get to experience. We're going to show you how.
When we started this project, the one thing that Tim said was he was sick and tired of hearing about 5 easy steps, 10 easy steps, the easy routes that people try to take to winning. Can you talk about how we set up this book? Because that is just not a reality.
Well, first, the ability to win is in all of us. Winning is everywhere. Every minute, you have the opportunity to win. We win all the time, and we don't even recognize it. And the ability to consistently win, you have to continue to build on those small wins. You have to recognize how you got that win and continue to build on it. Listen, the terms that people love to throw out all the time, that's not what we're going to talk about. Let me tell you, winning is going to invite you to many parties. You've actually attended them, but it doesn't even know you're there. How many times have you been sitting somewhere and winning just knocks your glass over? It is not winning's job to understand you. It's your job to recognize winning and see what this race is about.
So this book really is not about the glory and the cheerleading and the pat on the back. It's about the reality of what you go through to win, the obsession, the fear, the pain, the loneliness, the things that you've lived in your life, the things that you've seen your clients live through, and what you know that true winners experience on their way to the winner's circle over and over and over again.
Everyone wants to talk about those easy steps. Well, what Sherry just mentioned, those are the steps no one wants to talk about. We are. Those are the steps that are the most crucial in order to win, in order to win at the highest level. Everybody sees winning as this bright light with a halo on it. But when winning turns its back on you, which it often does, that's when you see the fangs. And if you don't know how to deal with the fangs, there's no chance of ever seeing the halo.
We start the book with a very personal story about your dear friend and client, Kobe Bryant. Very difficult story for you to tell, and sometimes very hard to hear. Do you want to share that here?
I must. I have to. Because if I don't, I would be disrespecting him. He would want me to share it. So I must. The chase. 1 week before my friend and client, Kobe Bryant, died in a helicopter crash, we spoke on the phone for the last time. We hadn't talked in a while, and neither of us apologized for not being in touch more often. We sent an occasional text just to check in. He was busy, I was busy. All good. We'd have plenty of time to catch up soon. Since the end of his basketball career in 2016, Kobe actually seemed busier than he'd been as a player. He may have not been in the gym at 4 a.m. putting up shots as he did for many years we worked together, but he was still working on new endeavors and obsessions during those dark, lonely hours that haunt every true competitor. He already won an Oscar, launched a series of best-selling children's books, created several television productions, and was traveling to coach his daughter Gianna's basketball team when the chopper crashed and they were both tragically killed, along with seven others. He hadn't slowed down at all. He was still driven to achieve more and more. "Rest at the end," he said, "not in the middle." During the 2019 NBA Finals, a reporter asked him why he didn't look happy after the Lakers took a two-game lead over the Orlando Magic. Kobe gave him that iconic Mamba glare and said, "Job not finished." Three words that summed up everything about him. On a last phone call, we talked for a while and made plans to get together at the upcoming All-Star Game in Chicago. That meeting would never happen. Our conversation ended like this. "You good?" I asked. "Yeah, I'm good. Always chasing that win. Never done." I hear those words over and over. Always chasing that win. Never done. Kobe's life was a series of wins, fueled by his insatiable hunger to succeed. The more you told him it couldn't be done, the more he wanted to do it. He had to know why, when, how much, how long. Every detail mattered to him. He couldn't just take a bike ride. He had to ride in the desert at the hottest time of the day just to prove to himself that he could. He never just watched film. He broke it down frame by frame, analyzing every movement, every variation. He played with a concussion in an All-Star game, unbeknownst to anyone else, to see how it would feel. He didn't just call his friend and idol, Michael Jordan, to ask what's up. He called him in the middle of the night, asking questions and looking for ways to become 0.0001% better. Everything he did in basketball and in life was about his desire to win. As an athlete, as a father, as a creator, as a dreamer of what could be next, he looked winning in the eye over and over and demanded more. More success, more victories, more accolades, more time with his family, more time to run his race to greatness. For all the times winning said yes to Kobe, on January 26th, 2020, it finally said no. "I know that sounds harsh. I just can't look at it any other way." Winning doesn't apologize, and it doesn't explain. It throws a party in your honor, refusing to give you the place and time, and sticks you with the check. It pours your champagne and knocks over the glass. You reach out to shake its hand, and it has no idea who you are. Winning puts you on the biggest stage and shuts off all the lights. In my 30-plus years of working with the greatest competitors of our time, from Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant and Dwayne Wade and Charles Barkley and countless others, to CEOs and elite achievers in all walks of life, I've seen winning in all its glorious generosity and all of its excruciating cruelty. One day it wears a halo, the next day it has fangs. You don't get to decide which it will be. You can only chase it. And if you're willing to pay the price, you might catch it. Briefly. I just wanted to share that personal story with you. Now, everyone, let's get in this unforgiving race.
The ability to win is in all of us. For some, it's the first championship. The first million, the new business, the new house. For others, it's finishing a workout or finishing school, sending a kid to college, buying that first car, going a whole day without smoking, ending a bad relationship, asking for a raise, seeing the last open parking space and grabbing it before the other guy gets there, making a U-turn and getting away with it, getting up every day and putting your 2 feet on the floor. Winning is everywhere. Every minute, you have the potential to recognize an opportunity, push yourself harder, let go of the insecurity and fear, stop listening to what others tell you, and decide to own that moment. And not just that one single moment, but the next one, and the next. And before long, you've owned the hour, and the day, and the month. Again. Again. That's how you win. It doesn't happen all at once. For my athletes, it starts with the first workout in the off-season, builds until the last second of the championship game, and continues into the first workout of the next off-season. For my business clients, who play a harder schedule than any athlete, it begins with an unpredictable array of opponents with no off-season, no playbook, and no clock to stop the action, with unofficial scorekeepers and referees who are constantly changing the rules. For everyone, there are endless setbacks, challenges, roadblocks, letdowns, and issues that force most people out of the race. But if you can stay with it, if you can survive the battlefield in your mind, if you can tolerate fear and doubt and loneliness, winning would like a word with you. Winning is the ultimate gamble on yourself, the difference between dreaming what could be and actually living it. Winning drives you forward. Every time you advance, you can hear the steel bars clank shut behind you. They are real, and they are earned. Now you can't go back, only ahead. You can't unlearn what you've learned. You can't unfeel what you've felt. Winning never lies, but it always hides the truth. It tells you everything you want is so close, and then laughs as it slams the door in your face. It tells you all your goals and dreams are impossible, and then taunts you to keep going. One more step. One more step. One more step to an uncertain destination that might not even be there. Winning is craziness. It doesn't sleep and doesn't understand why you do. It refuses to share time or space with others in your life, like a jealous lover who demands all of you and gets it. It's a driving obsession that looks irrational to others and perfect to you. Winning is unforgiving. If you screw up, if you lay down, if you show weakness, you're done. It shows you the best of you and the worst. Winning keeps its hands in its pockets so it doesn't accidentally point to someone unworthy. It holds you up to the sun and watches you burn. If you manage to reach the top, winning will be there to greet you with open arms, just before it pushes you off the ledge to make room for someone else. It's your ultimate reality check, a scorching reminder of who you really are and who you're pretending to be, and forcing you to reconcile the difference. Winning is the lover who takes you to paradise all night long and disappears before morning. It's the dream you can't remember when you wake up. Winning is unapologetic. You can be replaced. You will be replaced. I know it's common in books like this for the experts to give you steps. 5 easy steps. 10 secret steps. 20 steps I just made up for this book. Seriously? You can't buy a map to the top. If you could, everyone would be up there. They're not. The steps to winning are infinite and constantly shifting. One minute you see a step in front of you, the next moment it's quicksand. Most people don't see that step disappear until it's too late. They get sucked into the quicksand and give up. Winning doesn't care if you can walk up the steps. Anyone can do that. It wants to know what happens when you miss that step, when you can't see or feel what's in front of you, when you have to trust yourself and believe what you feel, not what you see. Sometimes you take those steps one at a time, sometimes two at a time. Some days, you'll feel so good you'll want to sprint. Other days, you're crawling on your hands and knees, gasping for breath and wishing you'd never started this race. You'll slip and tumble and lose everything you just gained. And when you finally make some progress, more steps to climb. There's a pebble in your shoe, a blister on every toe. Your lungs want to explode. Every day, every damn day. 10 steps. Wouldn't that be nice? 10 steps are a convenient way to simplify and sell success, but hardly effective. In 2013, I wrote a book called Relentless, From Good to Great to Unstoppable, about mental dominance and the character traits of elite achievers, how they think and act and strategize. I call those individuals cleaners, and if you read the book, you know there are numerous traits that define a cleaner. But there is one thing all cleaners have in common: the ability to achieve the end result over and over. They don't just have a great game or a big month. They have iconic careers that set the standard for everyone else. They take their teams from playoffs to finals to championships. They take their businesses from the basement to 7 figures to 8 figures to 3 commas. They don't need to be told how. They figure it out and execute repeatedly. I was honored and blessed by the magnitude of support for Relentless from athletes and CEOs, parents and entrepreneurs, entertainers and doctors and presidents and, well, every possible kind of competitor, each running his or her race to greatness. The most common message? I thought I was the only one. Thank you for telling me I'm not crazy. You're not crazy. There are a lot of us out there. But I was also intrigued by this occasional criticism. This book doesn't tell you what to do. That is correct. Why the hell do you want to be told what to do? I don't tell my clients, be relentless or you got this. They feel it. They know. The greats fall and stumble and gasp for air just like you do, but they keep going. They already know that at some point, the ground beneath them will shift and give way. They're ready for that. They trust there's another step, even when they can't see it. They don't think about the pain and sacrifice. They just see the end result, winning. They stay on that road, and they keep chasing greatness. Thinking back over the years, all my clients chase something. A record, a paycheck, a legacy, a ghost. MJ chased immortality and caught it. He will live forever. Kobe will also live forever. He chased immortality too. But before he could catch it, immortality caught him. What are you chasing? What's chasing you? Because if you're comfortable with sacrifice and pressure and criticism and pain, if you can learn to focus on the result instead of always focusing on the difficulty, you can chase winning, fight for it, and defend your right to catch it. But I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm going to show you an intensely honest and raw picture of what it truly takes to navigate the roadblocks and obstacles and challenges that get in the way, slow you down, and threaten your dreams. I'm giving you the action plan to achieve both success and mastery of the relentless mindset. You can't have one without the other. This is how the greats control and survive the journey, and how you can too. And by the end of this book, you won't have to be told. You'll know. In April 2020, ESPN and Netflix aired The Last Dance, the long-awaited documentary on Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls' run for their 6th and final championship together. As MJ's trainer for 15 years, I considered it a privilege to be included among those who were interviewed and participated in the series. For many, it was a vividly nostalgic trip down memory lane, with videos and photos and interviews with the greats, stories never told, unfinished business to debate, and scores to settle. For others, it was a bittersweet drama about relentless excellence at all costs. Unapologetic, unrelenting, unforgiving, unforgettable. For those who lived it, The Last Dance was about one thing, winning. Those years became the platform for my career with the greatest athletes of our time and the foundation of the work I do today with high achievers in sports, business, and all walks of life. Those who never stop chasing greatness, however elusive it might be. For more than 30 years, I've witnessed winning at the highest level and experienced losing at a level you can't comprehend. I've seen winners lose and losers win. I've tasted both extremes. My chase continues. So does yours. Let me take you into the world of elite cutthroat competition and show you how to navigate a road that can't be found on any GPS. There is no map, no light, no pavement. It's the road to paradise, and it starts in hell. You have been chosen, not by others, but by yourself. Welcome to winning.
This is our second book together, the first one being Relentless. And what I know about you from our many years of working together is that you have zero tolerance for cliches and BS about what it means to be successful and win. When people say things like, you got this, and someone crushed it, and they're a legend, and it's epic and life-changing, I see you cringe because you know that it's just not about that. You have your own set of language for this, don't you?
I do have my own set of language because winning has its own set of language. And that's why people don't win, because they don't understand the language of winning. The language of winning does not have cliches in it. All right. Those things are done to protect the individuals. That's why we use the cliches. It's to protect them. The unforgiving race of winning, it's not fair. It's not there to protect you. Let me give you the description of winning, of what the true competitors describe it as. You ready for this? It's uncivilized. It's hard. It's nasty. It's unpolished. It's dirty. It's rough. It's unforgiving. It's unapologetic. It's uninhibited. And once you understand that language, you'll understand that winning is everything.
So based on your language of winning, you've created a list of definitions that form the rest of this book, and you call them the Winning 13, because these were the 13 things to you that defined what it truly takes to win. And they're not pretty. They're not glamorous. They're quite harsh. Can you talk about how you built this list and what the listener is about to find out?
Think about every win you've had in your life, big or small, what it took to get that win. The win itself may have been glamorous, but to get to that victory, to get to that win, nothing about it was glamorous. This book is about the grit. This is not about the glory and the payday. Winning is about the obstacles and challenges and the pain. Yes, the pain you have to go through to get there. The amount of time you spend dealing with the obstacles and the challenges and the pain, it's way more time than you actually spend enjoying winning. So learn to deal with those things and you'll win more often. And you'll be able to navigate the race over and over again, because the race never ends.
Then let's get started.
The language of winning.
If you're the kind of person who needs to get pumped up, if you motivate yourself and others by yelling, "Let's do this," and "You got this," if you frequently announce on social media that you crushed it and killed it and nailed it, this is going to hurt. I don't care. I'm just letting you know. Winning has its own language, and it doesn't speak bullshit. Everyone is not a legend or a beast. Every event or interview is not epic and life-changing. Every athlete who plays well in the first game of the season is not necessarily going to be a problem for the league or anyone else. Everyone driving a Ferrari is not on fire. Winning requires real talk. Or even better, no talk at all. For example, in the language of winning, there is no talk about motivation. Motivation is entry level, the temporary rush you get from eating too much frosting. It's that incredible riptide of artificial power and passion and ravenous energy. Right before it wears off, and you're suddenly face-planted on the hard, cold floor wondering what the hell happened. Motivation is for those who haven't decided whether to commit to their goals or how much time, effort, and life they're willing to invest to achieve them. I'm not measuring their level of success. Someone can be broke or out of work or overweight or in a bad situation and extremely motivated to change that. I'm talking about their need to have others push them into action with the swift kick in the ass. I don't work with clients who need that kick in the ass. If you come to me, I need to know you're already kicking your own ass and you're ready for more. Likewise, I'm not a motivational speaker. I don't write motivational books. I don't want to fire you up. That's your job. My job is to take your greatest achievements and build on them. I want to speak to you in a language that takes your best work and makes it better. That's the language of winning. So, if you expected this book to be about the glory of championship rings and medals and trophies and plaques on the wall, if you're here for poetry about how you got this and everyone is a winner, you picked the wrong book. There are no backslaps or participation trophies here. There are no rewards for showing up. I'm not going to tell you what to wear to the parade. This is about what you'll go through in the race to greatness. It's about the blood on your hands from a tug of war with a ghost you can't see, up to your ankles in shit, surrounded by others trying to bury you in it. The unbearable loneliness and exhaustion. The intense fear of what's ahead for you and what isn't. If that sounds abnormal, then I'm doing my job here. Ask anyone who has actually won something, in sports or business or anywhere you have to compete with others and with yourself, and they'll tell you the same thing. There's nothing normal about winning. If you need normal, if you need to fit in, be prepared for a long stay in the middle of the pack. Winning requires you to be different, and different scares people. So if you're worried about what others will say, the long-term effects, the sacrifices you'll make, the sleep you'll lose, your family being angry, I can't help you with that. There's nothing typical about the lifestyle and choices you'll have to make. Winning is inside all of us, but for most, that's where it will stay, trapped under a lifetime of fear and worry and doubt. The race to greatness has no rules to protect you. Nothing says you're not going to lose, you're not going to get hurt, you're not going to do all this work for nothing. There's no guarantee it will be fair. Most likely, it will not be fair. You'll lose at the buzzer. You'll lose to someone who didn't work as hard as you did. You'll lose on a bad call or a bad play. Someone else will get the job. A pandemic will wipe out your season, your bank account, your career. Yet the prize at the end of that race remains so compelling, so addictive, so gorgeous, we keep running and stumbling and sacrificing and competing to catch it. Winning will do everything possible to keep you from catching it, but if you do, if you earn a seat at that magnificent table and you're finally included in the conversation, be prepared for two things. One, winning will give you the chair with one broken leg so you can never get comfortable. And two, you'd better be able to speak its language. The way you talk about winning has everything to do with whether you'll achieve it and keep it. You want to take the vocabulary test I give my clients? It's short and simple. Describe winning in one word. That's it. What does winning feel like to you? What does it represent? One word. Take a minute and jot down your first response. You can be honest. This is between you and you. I'm not giving out prizes here. I've asked this of countless athletes and business professionals and other individuals I work with, and the responses are always revealing. Here are some of the most common answers. Glorious, euphoric, success, domination, achievement, power, satisfaction, triumph, awesome, amazing. Not bad answers. If your answer was on that list, you fit right in with the majority, if that's where you want to be. Of course, anyone can fit in. Excellence stands out. Let me share with you some of the answers I've heard from the greats, not just in sports, but from the business world as well. Uncivilized, hard, nasty, unpolished, dirty, rough, unforgiving, unapologetic, uninhibited. Kobe, everything. Some people will stare into space, thinking about the enormity of the question. Some get emotional. Some just shake their heads. How do you define the one thing that has consumed and defined your entire life? I never asked MJ, but he answered it anyway in The Last Dance. In this one moment, he summed up everything he'd learned, everything he'd worked for, everything he knew about his lifelong partnership with winning. His answer is more than a word, but worth every one. I pulled people along when they didn't want to be pulled. I challenged people when they didn't want to be challenged. And I earned that right because my teammates who came after me didn't endure all the things that I endured. Once you joined the team, you lived at a certain standard that I played the game, and I wasn't going to take anything less. Now, if that meant I had to go in there and get in your ass a little bit, then I did that. You ask all my teammates. The one thing about Michael Jordan was he never asked me to do something that he didn't fucking do. When people see this, they're going to say, well, he wasn't really a nice guy. He may have been a tyrant. Well, that's you, because you never won anything. I wanted to win, but I wanted them to win and be a part of that as well. Look, I don't have to do this. I'm only doing it because it is who I am. That's how I played the game. That was my mentality. If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way. And then, famously, break. That unapologetic moment was so raw for him, he had to walk away from the interview momentarily to control the emotion. And that was just within the first hour of filming. Yes, winning is glorious and amazing and powerful and awesome and all those things. No one can deny that. But if you think that's all it is, then, as MJ said, you've never won anything. It's the punishment he took from other teams before elevating himself to becoming the greatest to ever play the game. The years of relentless pressure and scrutiny of everything he did. The single-minded focus on one thing, winning championships, not just for himself, but for everyone around him. It's Kobe tearing his Achilles, but refusing to go to the locker room until he shot and made two free throws. The infamous 4 a.m. trips to the gym to put up shots until he could master the shot he missed the night before. The countless hours alone in the dark, replaying every game and practice in his mind. It's Dwayne Wade fighting his way back from surgeries on his knee and shoulder that could have ended the careers of most players to win two more NBA championships to go with the one he already had, as well as an Olympic gold medal with the 2008 U.S. men's basketball team, which he led in scoring. It's Larry Bird playing through debilitating back pain. All the greats of the Jordan era, Charles Barkley, Patrick Ewing, Dominique Wilkins, John Stockton, Karl Malone, Clyde Drexler, realizing they could never win as long as MJ was in the race. That unforgiving race. Winning can be glorious, but it can also fuck you up. Think about the greatest achievers you know, the winners, the cleaners. Think about yourself. What have you gone through to get where you are? What's still ahead of you, seen and unseen? Does it all look like glory and triumph? If it does, your race is done. I congratulate you. Now please, step out of the way because the rest of us still have work to do. Look at these definitions of winning again. Uncivilized, hard, nasty, unpolished, dirty, rough, unforgiving, unapologetic, uninhibited, everything. If that describes your journey and how you attack your goals, we are speaking the same language. This book is about grit, not glamour. If your image matters more to you than your results, if you need to look and act a certain way to impress others, if fake it till you make it is your strategy for success, if you need approval to be who you really are, you're going to struggle. If we're working together, I don't need you to be civilized and polite. I need you to be hard, resilient, focused, truthful. I want you completely isolated in your mind, trusting your own voice and instincts to protect you from yourself and others. I want to see you flex the most important muscle in your race to greatness, the one no one sees but you, the I don't give a fuck muscle. We'll be working on that a lot in these pages. I need you to have a coat of Teflon, so nothing sticks to you and nothing gets in. The more you allow others to get under your skin, so every comment feels like criticism and every criticism makes you lash out, the more that protective coating will wear away until the hard outer shell becomes soft and weak. It goes without saying, winning has zero tolerance for soft and weak. The greats know how to put on a different face in certain situations that require it and take it off when it matters. MJ was polite and polished and said the right thing with his sponsors and audiences and interviewers, but put him in his own environment, in the gym, on the court, the real guy came out. No inhibitions, no limitations on what he would say or do to get his message across. Winning ignites a self-conscious awareness that others are watching. It's a lot easier to move under the radar when no one knows you and no one is paying attention. You can mess up and be rough and get dirty because no one even knows you're there. But as soon as you start to win and others start to notice, you're suddenly aware that you're being observed. You're being judged. You worry that others will discover your flaws and weaknesses, and you start hiding your true personality, so you can be a good role model, and good citizen, and a leader that others can respect. There is nothing wrong with that. But if you do it at the expense of being who you really are, making decisions that please others instead of pleasing yourself, you're not going to be in that position very long. When you start apologizing for who you are, you stop growing, and you stop winning. Permanently. The more you win, the more others will try to inhibit your growth, tell you to slow down, stay in your lane. They'll try to keep you in that one lane to control you. But winning is about choosing any lane, changing lanes when you need to, and navigating each with equal skill, with an extra gear no one anticipated. Winners speak a language that doesn't make sense to those who haven't experienced it. A quick glance, a steely stare, a roll of the eyes. Sometimes, total silence. You can't explain it, you can't teach it. But when you know, you know. It's not something you broadcast or brag about. Hey, I'm uncivilized, and also uninhibited. Because if you have to tell people, it's probably not true. But it's deep inside everyone, if you're willing to just let go and experience your own uncivilized, unapologetic, uninhibited power. For me, winning is about all those words and many more, as you will see. It's dead calm in the midst of total chaos. It can be the greatest joy and the loneliest feeling in the world. Not everyone feels it this way. You don't have to. I think real winners understand the experience. It's not the whooping and hollering and celebrating. It's that stunning recognition of what just happened. You chased this magnificent thing, this elusive end result, and you caught it. You fucking caught it. It's MJ sobbing on the floor, Kobe hugging the trophy alone in the corner. It's the CEO of a billion-dollar empire wondering what happened to the kitchen table that served as his first desk. No one knows what you went through to get there. No one understands what you'll have to do to get there again. I'm telling you this because when I sat down to write this book, I took my own test and started writing down my own definitions of winning. I thought about the wins and losses in every part of my life. As a child coming to this country with my parents and witnessing the sacrifice and determination they invested in our family. As a kid dreaming of playing in the NBA, losing my dream to an injury, and admitting to myself that I wasn't good enough. As a young man with a vision of helping professional athletes and having the greatest competitor in history become my first pro client. As a trainer and coach to some of history's greatest champions. As CEO of the world's most respected sports performance business. As an author and speaker, and above all else, a father. Winning has been my mentor and my executioner, my greatest ally and most formidable enemy. It's a puzzle of infinite pieces that don't easily fit together, some suspiciously missing, with no picture to show what the puzzle will look like if you ever finish. It's a black hole of desire and greed and insatiable hunger, a careless lover who draws you in and then tells you they're back on the market. I've looked winning in the eye long enough to see it wink and turn its back. I've been foolish enough to say, "See you next year," only to hear it whisper, "We'll see." I've seen what it can do for people and to people. What has it done for you? What has it done to you? Michael rarely speaks about it, and Kobe can't. But they spoke to me in discussions and debates no one else heard or saw, confiding things you haven't read in interviews or children's books. I still study both of them, and often continue those conversations in my mind. I asked you for your definition of winning. Now I'm giving you mine. There are 13. If you read Relentless, you may recall that I like to use the number 13 because I don't believe in luck. Neither does winning. Winning believes in winning. You may also recall that everything on my lists is ranked number 1. Because when you start ranking things 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., people think number 1 is most important, number 2 is less important, and everything else is just there to fill out the list. So we go with number 1 for everything, and you can read them in any order. The Winning 13. Number 1. Winning makes you different, and different scares people. Number 1. Winning wages war on the battlefield in your mind. Number 1. Winning is the ultimate gamble on yourself. Number 1. Winning isn't heartless, but you'll use your heart less. Number 1. Winning belongs to them, and it's your job to take it. Number 1. Winning wants all of you. There is no balance. Number 1. Winning is selfish. Number 1. Winning takes you through hell, and if you quit, that's where you'll stay. Number 1. Winning is a test with no correct answers. Number 1. Winning knows all your secrets. Number 1. Winning never lies. Number 1. Winning is not a marathon, it's a sprint with no finish line. Number 1. Winning is everything. This is what I know. Winning will cost you everything and reward you with more if you're willing to do the work. Don't bother to roll up your sleeves, just rip the fucking things off and do what others won't or can't. They don't matter anyway. You are in this alone. Stop being afraid of what you'll become. You should be more afraid of not becoming that. If you can't buy into this, if you believe you're not ready or not deserving, if you're not willing to commit to your own success, you've never won, and you probably won't. Because winners all understand one thing. There's a price to pay, and you must pay it.
You've built your whole career around thinking in a way that others don't think. You talk in this chapter about the importance of knowing how to think and not just following what others tell you to think. And because of your ability to do that, you've done amazing things throughout your career for your athletes who also think the way you do. Can you talk about that?
We go through our whole lives where everyone is telling us what to think, how to act, how to feel. And the best of the best, they know how to think. Kobe and I used to talk about this all the time. He used to always say, knowledge is power. And I used to tell him, only if you use it. But you have to use it, not directly the way it's given to you. You can't always go with what you think. When you take knowledge, take that knowledge and use it how to think. Forget about the right way. The right way has to be mixed with your own way. And that's how you get the balance of how to think and not what to think. Because the most successful individuals, the people that win over and over again, they understand how to think. Do you understand how to think? Because winning is going to require you how to think in order for it just to shake your hand. If it's always what you think, winning is going to put its hand out there and it's going to pull it away from you. Number one, winning makes you different, and difference scares people.
When I was training Michael, we set up a schedule that had him training on game days. This was unheard of at the time, and I heard about that from everyone. Work out on game days? You'll screw up his shot. He'll be fatigued. He'll be less athletic. Working out makes you less athletic? We saw it differently. Think about it. He played 3 to 4 games a week, plus travel days, plus practice, plus rest days. When was he supposed to train? No one really had an answer for that, because daily workouts were not the norm in the NBA at that time, nor were they a high priority. Very few players were on a regular training regimen, especially during the season, and none brought in someone from outside the organization to train them. MJ was the first when he hired me. Remember, he brought me in specifically to add muscle and power to his body, because he knew it would help him get past the bigger, stronger players who were physically beating him on the court. As his game elevated, so did the physical intensity he faced from every opponent, and he realized that to get to next level and win, he had to do something different. The Bulls had a conditioning program for their players, but he wanted and needed more. He was my first professional athlete. The world's greatest basketball player was working with a trainer who had never trained a pro. Improbable? Yes. Crazy? Maybe. But crazy, combined with the willingness to take a chance, is the secret weapon of winning. And we both had an impressive arsenal of crazy. If you think like everyone else, if you act like everyone else, if you follow the same protocols and traditions and habits like everyone else, guess what? You'll be like everyone else. Everyone wanted to be like Mike. Mike did not want to be like anyone else. Which led us to training on game days. If our goal was to continuously add muscle and make him stronger, as well as minimize injuries and preserve his longevity, it would have been counterproductive to ignore his training every time he had a game. Believe me, I studied and researched and tested him and looked at every possible variable that could impact his performance. We kept every game day consistent, trained the same muscles, did the same kind of workout, accounted for every component that might affect his shot and his endurance, eliminated as many of those variables as we could so his body became prepared to play under the same conditions, regardless of the game schedule. It became such a part of his routine that when we didn't work out, he'd feel the difference and comment, "Something doesn't feel right." Bottom line, it worked for him. And obviously the results spoke so clearly that I never had to respond to everyone who said it wouldn't work at all. It was never about being different for the sake of being different, or generating publicity, or trying to look clever and progressive. It was about understanding the difference between knowing how to think and being told what to think. Winners engage their minds and experiences to create new levels of greatness. I'm not just talking about athletes here. I'm talking about innovators and groundbreakers in business, entertainment, science, technology, education, medicine, parenting, every walk of life. Bill Gates personally checking every line of code for the first 5 years of Microsoft's existence. Jeff Bezos shipping books out of his garage. Sarah Blakely cutting the feet off her pantyhose. Elon Musk gazing up at Mars. They weren't afraid to think originally. They weren't worried about what others would think about their crazy ideas. That whole BS about thinking outside the box is just that, BS. Winners don't see the box. They see possibilities. They use their own decisions, successes, and failures as a springboard to elevate their thinking and results. Every great creation and invention started with people who knew how to think and didn't allow themselves to be told what to think. If you want to get to the elite level, this is what sets you apart. If you follow the textbook exactly, if you always do it the normal way, you can be very good at what you do. But what happens when there's a glitch or an unforeseeable issue that the textbook didn't cover? How do you manage when nothing is normal? People love to talk about pivoting in hard times, making a fast shift in a different direction, but you have to pivot and move towards something. You can't keep changing direction just to change direction. And unless you know how to think for yourself, you're just going to keep pivoting back and forth, this way and that way, waiting for someone to save you, waiting to be told what to think. If I gave you a piece of paper with 1,000 dots and told you to connect them, how would you attack that challenge? Would you form a picture of something recognizable? Would you create random shapes and designs? Would it look like a crazy doodle? Would you just tear it up? Those dots are your map of the race to greatness. You can go in a straight line. You can chart your own course. You can wander aimlessly. You can ask others how to get where you're going. You can quit. For me, those dots are about watching how a winner moves and figuring out how I can make him move better. I know how everyone else sees him. Can I see him differently? Can I take him in another direction? Can I make him fly? That's the artwork I see in those dots, the result of everything I've learned from others and elevated with my own knowledge. I know there's already a picture out there telling me what to do. I don't want that. I want to create my own. Winning watches to see if you're confident and bold enough to believe that different isn't wrong. It's the difference between lighting your own fire and waiting for someone to light it for you. To me, curiosity is the spark that lights that fire. I have a habit of staring at people, not to be rude, but to study and learn about them. I know it can make others uncomfortable, which is not my intention, but I believe it makes me good at what I do. I'd rather observe someone closely than rely on what I'm told. Are you asking questions? Do you allow your mind to wander into new possibilities and scenarios, no matter how far-fetched and unattainable they might seem, like you did when you were a kid? Kids understand curiosity. They see something interesting, and they have to play with it, eat it, throw it. They can't leave it alone. For a few minutes, it's the greatest thing they've ever known until an adult comes along and takes it away. They'll ask question after question after question until the adult can't take it anymore and tells them to stop asking so many questions. That was MJ and me in the beginning of our relationship. There was so much I wanted to know, so much I knew I could learn from him. I'd ask about everything until he finally said, "Man, you ask so many questions." I kept on asking. I already knew what I was supposed to think about him, and I knew what everyone else thought about him. I needed to know more than that. Kobe did the same thing with him. He'd call or text Michael in the middle of the night asking how he played against a certain guy, how he handled a situation, what he thought about this or that. and Michael would always answer his questions and help him learn. That's a major trait of the greats, by the way. They want to pass along their knowledge, so the next generation can keep learning. That's the difference between competing and winning. I hear this all the time from my corporate clients. We know how to compete. Now we need to learn how to win. It's not always the same thing. When you know what to think, you're ready to compete. When you know how to think, you're ready to win. Your education teaches you what to think. Life experience teaches you how to think. In school, you're tested after you learn. In life, the test comes before you learn. Coaches and bosses tell you what to think. Doing the work tells you how to think. Your parents show you what to think. Adulthood shows you how to think, if you're open to learning. If you follow a recipe for the perfect chocolate cake, you'll get that exact cake because you were told what to do. But after you've made it a few times, maybe you start thinking of a way to make it even more perfect, so you change something in the recipe. And you were right. It turned out even better. That's about how to think, not what to think. You can go into a big chain restaurant, order the mac and cheese, and have complete confidence that you'll find the exact same meal in 100 other locations, prepared exactly the same way. That's a system in place, with procedures and guidelines. And if you're in charge of preparing that dish, you don't have the option to think of a better way to make it. Master chefs have countless ways to make that dish, never the same way twice. How to think, not what to think. Thinking for yourself creates independence, which many of the self-help experts out there dread, despite their promises to the contrary. Why? The more you think for yourself, the less you'll need the experts. If you're always reading self-help books and listening to motivational talkers and following inspirational geniuses on social media and podcasts, if you can't make a decision without consulting mentors and masterminds, you're being told what to think. You're being told, "I'm successful. This is how I did it. This is what I believe, so you should believe it too." And it all makes sense, sounds so good, so you accept it as truth. But how do you know? Are you experiencing it? Using it? Are you staying with it long enough to fully absorb what you're learning, or are you jumping ahead to the next hot thing? Are you putting action behind all that advice so you can find out for yourself? You may be getting a lot of great guidance and knowledge, but it's always going to be someone else's knowledge until you question it, adapt it, and find out for yourself if it works for you. Kobe used to say, "Knowledge is power," and I'd tell him, "Only if you use it." He definitely used it. And yes, I know this applies to me and my books and the ideas I share with you. And if this topic makes you stop and think about how to adapt what I told you and apply it differently to your own life, then I'm doing my job. I want you to question what I believe. It's precisely the reason some readers griped that Relentless didn't tell them what to do. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to tell you what to think. I want you to learn how to think, to become involved in the process of learning so you can create your own ideas and thoughts, answer your own questions, and know how to create solutions when others don't even understand the issues. I work with my sports and business clients the same way when we're working on mental toughness and focus. At first, most want to talk every week with a standing appointment. But I don't work that way because to me, that's just waiting to be told what to do every week at the same time. Oh, good, it's Tuesday. Now I can deal with this issue I should have handled 5 days ago, but instead, I waited for my scheduled call with Tim. We'll still talk on a regular basis, but not just because we're supposed to. I want them thinking for themselves, working on their own abilities to make decisions and manage issues. I want to see them create ways to win and execute those ideas without running them by me first. That's how you learn to think for yourself. Sometimes when clients are on a hot streak, I don't want to talk to them at all. My total communication with them might be a look or a nod, and many times That says it all. They already know and feel things are going well. I don't want to alter their thinking. We don't need to discuss what's going right. They just need to keep doing it. Everyone looks for the key to winning, like you can carry it in your pocket and pop it into a lock. There is no key. It's a combination vault of infinite numbers and infinite outcomes, with rusted, decayed dials that barely move, and digits that have been rubbed bare by countless desperate fingers trying to turn them in their favor. Most people will solve some of the combination, but they give up trying to figure out the rest and settle for what they have. A select few will keep fiddling with the dials, hoping to get those last couple of numbers. But if you stay with it long enough, if you can elevate your thinking and your expertise to a level that allows you to figure out the complete combination, you can bust the lock on winning's heavily guarded fortress. And while you're celebrating, winning is already changing the combination. For me, the challenge has always been about working that combination so I can find new ways to make great competitors even greater. I can't get them there by applying the same techniques everyone else uses, because we're not talking about getting 10% better or 5% better. The goal is 1/10,000% better, because these performers are already among the best at what they do. Consider an athlete like Michael Phelps, for example, who won 23 Olympic gold medals and 28 medals overall by finding ways to shave 1/100 of a second off his times. You can't achieve that by training and thinking like everyone else. You have to be innovative and dedicated enough to go where others can't or won't. So when I'm working with a competitor who is so elite that he's literally competing against himself, I have to combine all the research and teachings and data, add the unique component of his specific needs and challenges, and create solutions that are unique to him. When I was training MJ, the Bulls strength coach asked why I had him doing bicep curls. The theory was that biceps were just for show and didn't really make someone a better basketball player. And that was probably true. But we were going for that 1/10,000%, which included the intimidation factor of his bigger, stronger, more dominant physique. What's the first thing you see on a basketball player when he takes off his warm-ups? Those arms. Details matter. It works the same in business. Look at a company where everyone has the same training, the same procedures, the same rules and regulations, the same products and services to sell. Everyone represents the same name on the logo. But some will excel above and beyond because they advance their skills and their thinking. That's the difference between learning what is handed to you and understanding how to build on that. Winning requires you to learn, question what you learned, and then learn more. You have to be willing to challenge what you've been taught and learn it again with a different perspective. Everything I've done with my clients has been the result of helping them close the gap between being the best and being the best ever. Big difference between those two. I had to challenge traditional training techniques and learn them all over again through the lens of what I was discovering on my own. None of my college professors ever advised me to take the greatest athlete who ever played, have him train on game days, and give him a steak a few hours before tip-off. Yes, he ate steak before games. Back in the 80s and 90s, the nutrition prescription for athletes was carbs, carbs, and more carbs. Everyone was eating rice and pasta for fuel, but that wasn't working for MJ. Aside from feeling bloated, he was playing so hard that it just wasn't enough for him. When the team was playing at home, he was eating at 3:30 in order to get to the stadium by 6 o'clock. So he was starving by the 7:30 game time, and by the fourth quarter, he could feel his energy decreasing. So we added a small steak to his pregame meal. Now listen, I'm not telling you to eat steak before a game. I'm not giving you nutritional advice here. I'm telling you, we had to devise a new plan for Michael based on his body chemistry and schedule, his playing minutes, and the massive amount of energy he expended on the court. The steak slowed down the digestion of everything else he was eating, the starches, vegetables, etc., and kept his blood sugar consistent so he had more energy throughout the entire game. It wasn't something I learned in a book or nutrition class, it just made sense to me. I knew what we'd tried and what hadn't worked. Let's do this instead. We can always try pasta or something else at halftime. But for now, we'll try steak. Believe me, I've tried a lot of ideas that didn't work at all. I've spent hours putting together the perfect program, only to take my client through the workout and realize within 5 minutes that I have to throw out the whole thing. I'm not a genius, far from it. I'm not going to tell you I always know the answer, but I'm going to keep trying solutions until I find it. Winning demands that you look past the right way and create your own way. Coaches love to ridicule players who bend over when they feel fatigued. They say it's a sign of weakness and tell them to stand up straight instead, with hands on their head. It never made sense to me, even when I was playing. You're telling me that if I'm fatigued, I'm supposed to hold my arms over my head to open my lungs more? If I'm breathing hard while training or playing, my lungs are already open. It always felt more natural to me to bend forward. So I finally told Michael, "Grab your shorts." He thought I was crazy. "Just do this," I said. "Bend over when you need a second to catch your breath and grab the bottom of your shorts." Not hands on his knees, because I didn't want him putting pressure on his knees. But when he started grabbing the bottom edge of his shorts, he realized he was able to breathe more deeply and recovered so much faster. You can search the internet for yourself and find hundreds of pictures of him on the court between plays holding the edge of his shorts. We worked on every possible detail. Fingers, toes, ankles, everything that could go wrong, we addressed it. It's no coincidence that he played every game most of our years together. We created the opportunity for that to become a reality. That was our style of load management, managing his body to play the complete load of 82 regular season games, plus potentially 26 more in the playoffs, as well as the preseason. How to think, not what to think. With Kobe, there were very few things he wouldn't try in his training if he believed we could get that 1/10,000%. When I first told him about bending over to catch his breath, he said he wouldn't do it because it didn't look good. Winning makes everyone look